Hi, thank you for the introduction. I'm very happy to be here after, well, I left about a year ago, and now I'm here for the first time. I want to tell you today about disorder. So the talk that was announced is disorder, symmetry, and universality classes. So what I want to talk to you today about is disorder and its symmetry and universality classes. So, well, first I want to start with saying what I mean when I say disorder. But disorder can mean many things, but the way how I encountered disorder in my work is disorder, study of disorder, is a study of equations of motion which are random. Now, why would we want to study random equations of motion? Well, often this is because maybe we don't know the equations of motion exactly. We have a physical situation where we can only guess roughly how the equations look like, and then maybe we approximate them with, we say that maybe they're random because, for example, there could be some time-dependent force, and we don't really know how it changes with time, but we can just say that maybe it's random with time. And an example of that is Brownian motion, where we deal with molecular collisions. Or maybe it's because we study something, say a piece of metal which has impurities, and so we don't really know where the impurities are, but we know that they're there. And so maybe a way to study this piece of metal is by saying that the impurity creates potential, which is random. And, well, when we do experiments on this piece of metal, we don't measure this potential. We only measure something which somehow is already averaged over positions of these impurities everywhere. And so, because of this, it's convenient when we work it in a theoretical sense to just introduce random potential and compute things as they are averaged over this random potential. So, well, this situation, disordered equations of motion, they've been studied in physics for about maybe 100 years. And well, when I encountered these equations, I discovered that somehow, roughly speaking, you can divide all these problems with disorder into two groups. One of them is time-dependent disorder, disorder which depends on time. And the other problem is when disorder doesn't depend on time. And you'd think that it's somewhat superficial, but interestingly enough, for some reason, there is a big difference in how much advance people managed to do in the last hundred of years in these two problems, which look almost the same. So apparently, even though, well, sometimes we say that time is space and the same thing, but with problems with disorder, apparently time is special. For example, an example of a problem where disorder depends on time is Brownian motion. Well, we know Brownian motion occurs because there are random collisions of Brownian particles with molecules. So we say, well, maybe there's a particle moves in something viscous, its velocity is proportional to a force, and the force is just random, and it changes randomly. And so this problem is very simple and can be solved in almost a few lines. On the other hand, a very similar problem occurs in turbulence. There we also have time-dependent disorder. And the reason is because in turbulence, we don't really know, well, the equations are so chaotic that we don't know how the fluid moves. And so somehow we try to say, well, maybe it's random in time in some sense, and we try to average over this randomness. And this problem has never been solved. People don't know how to solve this problem. On the other hand, there is also a class of problem of time-independent disorder. And one very well-known example is a random potential, a particle which moves in a random potential. That problem shows up in mesoscopic physics. But there are other examples. For example, spin glasses is a very famous problem. Spins, they interact, and we assume that interactions between spins are random. We try to solve it. And so somehow these problems, a lot more by now is known about them than about time-dependent disorder problems such as turbulence. So I would say that when disorder doesn't depend on time, then this problem is difficult and yet solvable. When the problem does depend on time, then it's either trivial, such as Brownian motion, or very difficult, such as turbulence. So in a way, somehow time-independent disorder gives us a middle ground. And remarkable advances were achieved in the last, I would say, 10 years in the study of time-independent disorder problems. And so I want to tell you a little bit today about these achievements, about how we now understand that time-independent disorder problems can be classified to a point that if you work on some problems in physics and you encounter a time-independent disorder problem, you don't have to solve it. You can just look in the table and get the answer. But the path to this answer is not simple. Yeah, this problem has been solved before, right? But it was solved already. So today I want to talk about time-independent disorder, because as I said, somehow it's in the middle ground between very difficult and very simple. And so one paradigm of problems with time-independent disorder is a set particle which moves in the random potential. And is that the point there? So this problem has been studied by many people over many years, beginning from probably 50s. So we have a Schrodinger equation, we have a potential V of X, which is assumed to be random. Often people say, well, it's random and it's not correlated at different points, because usually it comes from some impurities in metal or in a superconductor. And well, when we encounter a problem like this, usually when we have a Schrodinger equation, we want to solve, we want to find eigenstates and eigenfunctions. But here the potential is random, so to try to find eigenfunctions and eigenstates would be very difficult, because the potential is just very complicated. So, but on the other hand, we don't need eigenstates and eigenenergies. Perhaps we want to compute something else. And some of the quantities which people would want to compute are listed here. One of them would be the density of states. So the density of states is just the probability that there is a state with a given energy, as it's written here. And in problems with disorder, or maybe in mesoscopic physics where this problem comes from, this is an important quantity to compute, because it tells you how much available phase space we have for our electrons which move in this potential. So we need to know what is the freedom this electron has that moves with a given energy. So that's one of the quantities people like to compute. And the other quantity is conductivity. This thing is conducting. So somehow intuitively we think that, well, if there is impurities and they generate this potential, and so electrons scatter of these impurities, and intuitively we understand it will be diffuse. There are some simple quasi-classical calculations which explain that it will diffuse. And that will lead to finite conductivity. And maybe we want to compute this conductivity. And then another phenomenon which people have been discussing for years, since 50s, probably since Anderson, is that it turns out that often when we have an equation like this, the wave function, a typical wave function, which will be solutions of this equation, they will be not extended in space, but they will be localized. They'll occupy a finite amount of space. And often that happens even at very high energies, when naively we would expect that the motion should be infinite. So when the particle is allowed to go all the way to infinity, we don't expect to have bound states. But this looks like a bound state, even though it's not. It's a more subtle phenomenon which comes from interference, from scattering of this random potential. And so we want to compute this localization length. And so all these problems people encountered and studied. And so today I want to start by telling you how you can approach this kind of equation and how can you compute these quantities. So when people first encounter this equation, well, they try to solve it by various means. Obviously, you cannot solve it as a Schrodinger equation because the potential is random. But maybe you can somehow come up with a way to compute various quantities without actually solving this equation. And so the first method of solving it, as far as I know, at least in one dimension, was proposed by Halperin in 1965. So what Halperin suggested to do, he said, well, it's hard to solve this equation and find eigenstates, but how about this? We just solve the Schrodinger equation as a function of x and compute the wave function and compute the number of times it crosses well, it turns into zero. Well, this should better be absolute value. So the absolute value of the wave function turns into zero. These are so-called nodes of the wave function. And we know very well from elementary courses in quantum mechanics that the number of nodes is equal to the number of states with energy less than the given energy at which we computed this wave function. And so the idea was that somehow, maybe even when the disorder potential is complicated, it's not so hard to count the nodes. And indeed, so what he proposed to do was, he said, let's parameterize our equation like this, introduce some kind of logarithmic derivative of the psi, and then as a consequence of Schrodinger equation, it satisfies this equation. And so let's look at this equation now. It's rather interesting. When, if sigma is large and positive, this term makes sigma go down, so sigma becomes smaller. But if sigma is large and negative, this term still makes sigma go down. So if V of x fluctuates in such a way that sigma becomes large and negative, it'll keep going and becoming more and more negative, and this term will become negligible because sigma squared will be growing, but d sigma dx keep remaining negative. So sigma will go all the way until it reaches minus infinity. And by looking at this formula, we recognize that the point when sigma is minus infinity is exactly the point where psi turns into zero. So all we need to do, Halperin said, is to look at this equation, treat it as a function of x, solve it, and count the probability that sigma is a large and negative number. And that gives us a number of times per unit space, per unit length, which psi turns into zero. And so that gives us the number of states below given energy. And it turns out that this program can be carried out to the very end. And actually, the reason why it can be carried out to the very end is because in this problem, space looks like time, and V of x looks like random force. We don't have time anymore, but if we interpret x as time, this looks just like some kind of special Brownian motion. And as I told you before, some time-dependent problems are very simple, and this is one of them. This problem is solvable. And so he solved it, and he got the exact answer of a density of states of a particle which moves in a random potential. And here is his solution. It looks rather complicated. Well, this is the exact solution which I took from the book by Itzigson and Druffy, where it's discussed. And well, the formula itself is not very illuminating, but it's very easy to see from it that at very large positive energies, this formula goes as 1 over square root of phi. And at large negative energies, it goes as the stretch exponential. So here is this curve, the density of states of a particle which moves in a random potential. And we notice that at very large energies, somehow the particle shouldn't even notice that we have this potential. It moves so fast, just skips it. So in this case, the density of states should be the same no matter if there is random potential or there isn't. But if there is no random potential, we know the spectrum is p squared. So it's really trivial to compute the density of states in one line. The probability that there is a state of this energy, and it goes as 1 over square root of phi. So at very large energy, it's 1 over square root of phi, but at small energies, for a free particle, the density of states diverges. But as soon as we turn on disorder, well, it no longer diverges, it just becomes smooth. Well, we have certain density of states at negative energies. Potential can be negative, can create potential can be negative, can create negative energy states. And overall, the curve, well, it's interesting, of course, because we have this exact expression, but one could say even that this curve doesn't have any interesting features. It's just some line which never turns into infinity, never turns into zero, and one could argue that, well, how do I know that this potential was this random Gaussian disorder which was assumed in this calculation? Maybe potential had some correlations, or maybe the potential was slightly different, and maybe this formula wouldn't be exactly true. But somehow we would expect probably that the density of states would still remain to be smooth, continuous function with no singularities and no zeros. And indeed, a number of people repeated this calculation for various distributions of random potential. And every time they would manage to find the solution exactly, they would discover the density of states is a function which is perhaps different from this one, but it's just some line which changes and never turns to zero, never turns to infinity. And so, after a while, that was promoted to a principle. People said, well, maybe it's some kind of statement that things are universal. When we have motion and a random potential, and we look at the density of states, the density of states is more or less smooth, never tends to zero, never tends to infinity, doesn't do anything interesting. And that was supported by a large number of various calculations in different regimes.
This is also in higher dimension, as you say, in transparency.
Yes.
But Hauker's method is only for one dimension,
Yeah, so in higher dimensions, we could do different methods. For example, we can do perturbative expansion and powers of random potential, and we can actually show that it's controllable. Mm-hmm. And we can compute the density of states, and within that expansion, we can see that it's a smooth function which doesn't do anything interesting. Now, it turns out this is all not necessarily true. This was a conjecture which people made, and it is not correct. It is correct for the Hamiltonian I wrote in the previous transparency. But there are other Hamiltonians, which are somehow different from this one. And so I want to show you a Hamiltonian, which was first studied by Dyson, as many things in theoretical physics. It occurred to Dyson to look at this Hamiltonian, where we again have a random potential, but it's a strange random potential. It's a sum of two functions, and we assume that the function is random, also not correlated at different points, and also perhaps has an expectation at one point. Well, and the reason why Dyson was motivated by this equation is rather subtle. He was interested in the statistics of frequencies of balls of random masses connected by random springs. And somehow he showed that this is the same as trying to solve the Schrödinger equation. And well, there are maybe other reasons to study this equation. Some people recognize in this equation a strange random supersymmetric quantum mechanics with view of axis as potential. And then some people recognize in this equation a motion, a diffusion of a one-dimensional particle with some random potential which acts on this. So there are many ways to get it. And so there was a large interest to try to solve this kind of equation. And so what Dyson showed, he did this calculation, he discovered the density of states is not at all a smooth function. It actually diverges if expectation of V is equal to zero, then it diverges as 1 over E log cube E. And Dyson did his calculation for very special distribution of this random potential V of X. But then his calculation was repeated by other people for more generic distributions, and they would always get this universal law, 1 over E log cube E. So no matter how V of X is distributed, if it's not correlated at too large distances, if X and Y far enough, and if average of V is zero, then you always get 1 over E log cube E. And so you start thinking, well, maybe there's some universality at work here. Something is strange happening that always makes your density of states for small energies to be 1 over E log cube E. And notice, by the way, that if V does have an expectation, then the density of states changes. Now it vanishes the power law at small energies. And clearly, for standard Schrödinger equation, if V of X was just a Schrödinger potential, it wouldn't make sense to have non-zero expectation for V of X, because we can always shift V of X by a constant and put it into the energy. But for this kind of potential, we cannot anymore shift V by a constant. So clearly, different expectations of V of X might lead to different situations. And, well, it leads to this power law. And so this is the number of people who studied this problem and contributed to understanding why the density of states behaves like this. And so we could try to think why this happens and what is so different about this equation from the Schrödinger equation I studied before. And well, we could say, well, clearly because this looks like a square of some operator, this thing always has positive spectrum. All the energies are positive. So there's something special which goes on at energy equal to zero. And this is true. And so indeed, the spectrum doesn't go beyond energy equal to zero, unlike just motion and random potential. But look at contrast it with this case. What if we erase this term dv over dx completely, and we just look at this potential, Laplacian plus v squared? We can see that energy equal to zero is still a very special point. There are no negative energies. And yet, if we try to solve this problem, we will discover that its density of states look a lot more like the density of states of just usual Schrödinger equation. The only thing is that the density of states will turn into zero for negative energies. But for small energies, it will actually turn to zero as exponential of minus 1 over square root of 3, which is usually referred to as Lipschitz tail. And something like that happens to usual Schrödinger equation if random potential is chosen in a special way. Also, all the states will be localized, just as for usual one-dimensional Schrödinger equation. For this problem, by the way, localization length will be divergent. So, and that should be contrasted with statements people were making about that localization length never diverges in one dimension. Here it does. So there is something very special about this Hamiltonian, which sets it aside from, for example, this one, and it's more than just having positive spectrum. Well, but it had nothing to do actually with the correlation being a delta function. You can take it as a smooth delta function. You can spread it a little bit, and you will still get this spectrum. Also, another problem people like to look, they like to discretize this potential and look at matrices, random matrices which have sort of the same kind of structure, and they have exactly the same density of states, no matter where you look, you'll be. And so, after people thought about why this is so different, they made a conjecture. They noticed that this Hamiltonian has a certain property which usual Schrödinger equation doesn't have. And now we refer to this property as chiral symmetry. We noticed that the Hamiltonian I talked about can be written as product of two objects, and one of them is, well, the Gradient plus V, and the other is Kermitian conjugate of it. And we notice that we can write down an equivalent Hamiltonian, which looks like this. It has zeros on the diagonal and Q dagger off the diagonal. It's clear that if we take a square of this auxiliary matrix, we essentially go back to our original Hamiltonian. So we can, instead of looking at the spectrum of this Hamiltonian, we can just look at the spectrum of that Hamiltonian. But this auxiliary Hamiltonian has a strange symmetry. If we introduce a matrix, which looks like this, 1 minus 1, 0, 0. And if we conjugate this Hamiltonian with this matrix, it changes sign. It's exactly because we have nothing here. If there was there were terms here, then it wouldn't change sign. So some people say that sigma 3 is like gamma 5 in high energy physics. And so this thing had a chiral symmetry. So as a result of chiral symmetry, eigenvalues of this auxiliary H come in pairs. For every eigenvalue E, there's an eigenvalue minus E. And we can see it very easily by using the symmetry and applying it to the Schrödinger equation. So a conjecture was made that maybe the reason why the density of states behaved in such a strange way is directly related to the fact that this Hamiltonian has an interesting chiral symmetry. And this is actually true, but at this stage it's not clear why, but it is true. So before I go a little bit further and tell you, or try to tell you why the presence of this symmetry changes the spectrum so much, to a point that we say that now we're in a completely different universality class, I want to tell you a little bit more about why in the first place we would want to write a Hamiltonian like this one, which is Q dagger Q, where Q is a separator. It looks something artificial, which no one would probably want to study. But it turns out there's lots of applications for Hamiltonians like that. So one of them.
This is a case where the number of zero energy solution is a topological characteristic of the potential.
Well, yes, but the potential is random. So in practice, you never get an exact zero energy state. The zero energy solution will always be divergent, typically. There is a very small number of potentials for which it exists. But it's interesting that the probability of having very low energy state is very high. It's 1 over E log QV. So I want to bring to your attention to just random bond Ising model. An Ising model where the bonds are fluctuating. So everyone recognizes here that this is the partition function of the Ising model. And let's assume that J's are such that on the average they're equal to some number. And they're fluctuating, but with an amplitude, they're fluctuating, but with an amplitude which is much smaller than this number. I want to prevent J's from being negative. Because when they become negative, there's all sorts of problems related to spin glasses, which I don't want to have. I just want to understand, what is the effect on the Ising model of random J's? Well, it's an interesting problem, and actually there has been a lot of progress over the last maybe 20 years, or maybe even more, in understanding this problem. But right now, I don't want to look at this problem in its full glory. I want to look at a particular case where the randomness is such that the bonds are sort of correlated in the time direction, so that I can go from statistical mechanics to quantum mechanics. Let me show you what I mean by this. We know that a problem like this, if all the j's were constants, it can be mapped into a one-dimensional quantum problem. The standard mapping, this is called transverse field Ising model. It's a quantum one-dimensional Hamiltonian whose spectrum, or whose correlation functions are exactly the same as correlation functions computed here. Well, if I want this procedure to work for j's being random, and if I want this Hamiltonian not to depend on time, because I remind you that I like to talk about time-independent disorder, I have to assume that all bonds are equal in the time direction. So my Ising model have two directions. One of them I'll call them space, and the other time. And so these bonds, it's not equal to that bond, because each of them is random, oscillates around mean value. But in the time direction, they're all equal. This bond, its strength is equal to the strength of this bond, equal to the strength of this bond, and the same with vertical bonds. This strength is the same as this, is the same as this. And then we might be interested to find the spectrum of this time-independent Hamiltonian, but which is random in space, so this direction. Well, in particular, if all j's here are the same, it means that all j's and k's here are the same, and this problem is solvable. It's at one of the ways, actually, to solve Ising model. We can find that at t equal to c, which in this language means j is equal to k, density of state is equal to a constant. But at t not equal to tc, the spectrum is gapped. And we understand why, because at t equal to c, we're at the critical point, there should be no gap. If we go away from tc, the spectrum is gapped. But what happens when j's and k's become random? Something interesting happens. So here is the Hamiltonian. It turns out that we can do Jordan-Wigner transformation. It's a certain transformation which I don't want to write here, but I just wanted to state the result. This Hamiltonian can be mapped into this matrix, where Q is related to those J's and K's in the following way. So there's some matrix related to J's and K's, and it has this chiral structure. So somehow, right away, we know the answer. We don't have to solve it anymore, because I just told you that as soon as you get a Hamiltonian like this, and we're in one dimension, we know the spectrum. For example, we know that when t is equal to tc, density of states behaves as 1 over e log cube e. Then there is an area when t is somewhat different from tc. We will observe this other regime, Paolo spectrum, because you can show that corresponds to that potential having a non-zero expectation value. I told you that in that case, the spectrum changes into Paolo law. And finally, when t minus tc is larger than certain delta t, the exact value of delta t depends on how exactly this randomness works, and how j's and k's are distributed, then we go into a gapped phase. So unlike usual Ising model, where we have just a phase with a gap, which is ordered phase, or maybe disordered phase, and then one critical point of the transition. Here we have the whole area of points in the interval delta t around it. And at the critical point, the density of state divergent, then there's a certain regime where the density of states vanishes at small energies, but without hard gap, as a power law. And finally, there's a regime where density of states is gapped. Now, this was first understood by a number of people, and I think this regime is now referred to as Griffith singularities. And I think it probably was understood by McCoy and Griffiths originally. But they did it in a very complicated way. We did it almost in no time because we used results of others. This is the chiral matrix. So that's just how simply we can solve a random bondizing model and understand what is Griffith singularities. By the way, the exact nature of the singularities and what it means that we have this regime is not very well understood. People believe still that there is still a one point, t equal to c, where there is a transition between paramagnetic and ferromagnetic state. And then there is this regime where there are Griffith singularities, but apparently it cannot be, for example, experimentally observed. If you think about some realistic experimental situations where the bonds are random, because the singularities are very weak. This density of states translates into singularities and the free energy. All right. So now I want to tell you a little bit why the presence of chiral symmetry changes spectrum so much. Now that is actually very difficult to understand in a way, because the existing derivations in the literature are not very transparent. So I will try to argue along the lines how people argue right now, but I might say that I don't feel happy with these arguments. I think there has to be a better argument which explains why chiral symmetry changes spectrum so much. But let me just go along how these things are understood now. So it turns out that in the subject of random Hamiltonians, every correlation function of random Hamiltonian, or Green's functions of random Hamiltonians, can be mapped onto correlation functions of effective field theories. And these effective field theories take a form of sigma models. So they look like some path integral over Q. A Q is some matrix. Often it comes out to be supermatrix, depends on how you do your construction. And the action always begins with something which looks like a kinetic term of the sigma model. And then there is a coupling constant here. Now, so far I haven't explained why this is so. And in a way, I would say it's still mysterious to me why this is so. But in all cases where these things have worked out, this turns out to be true. So every random Hamiltonian somehow cannot know more than these sigma models know. Everything which random Hamiltonians know is also known to the sigma models. But the sigma models, there cannot be too many of them, because sigma models depend on only a few parameters. So they depend on this coupling constant, G, 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 and then depend on what kind of matrix Q is, and nothing else. In a way, dependence on the coupling constant is superficial, because coupling constant flows along the normalization group trajectories. So if we're interested in the infrared behavior, it doesn't matter what coupling constant we start with, still flow somewhere, and that's where we end up. So the only serious things which affect what we will get out of our random Hamiltonian is, what is the matrix Q? And now it turns out that if we impose a discrete symmetry on our random Hamiltonian, such as, for example, Schrodinger equation, but then we impose chiral symmetry and we get this other Schrodinger equation. So imposition of a discrete symmetry of that kind changes the kind of matrix we get in the sigma model. And that completely changes the behavior. In particular, if we use the sigma model to understand the density of states of the Hamiltonian and the random potential, we get a density of states which is more or less finite. But if we use the same sigma model but for a different matrix Q to understand this other random Hamiltonian, we will get the density of states, which goes as 1 over E log QV. And indeed, that was done with the help of sigma models. So this is a completely remarkable fact. So all which we need to do now is to understand how many sigma models we can write down, and also to understand which random Hamiltonian a sigma model corresponds to. And then we're done. And so this project was actually carried out by a number of people, but I think it would be fair to say that the first time it appeared in a very clear way was in the paper by Martin Zinnbauer in 1996, where he stated that there are only 10 ways you can write down the sigma models. So there are only 10 different behaviors in random Hamiltonians. And all random Hamiltonians you can possibly write down, somehow they have to fall into one of these 10 cases. So, obviously it's not a mathematical proof, because who knows, maybe we can come up with some new random Hamiltonian which is not related to sigma model.
D-dimensional Schrodinger equation without spin, or what's the capacity?
Yeah, it could be in D-dimensions. All we do is we change here number of dimensions, and it still works. It works in any dimensional space. Well, there is some, there's certain degree of applicability of the sigma models, I would say. So the mapping from the random Hamiltonian to sigma model is not exact, it's approximate. So there are certain regimes in which the mapping, if we look at it naively, it looks like it breaks down. And still, somehow, if we extract answers from the sigma model, even in those regimes, often, I wouldn't say always, it gives at least on a qualitative level correct answers. So in this, from this point of view, it looks like some kind of miracle, because even approximations which led to sigma model breakdown, and still the answer turns out to be correct. For example, if we write down the sigma model in one dimension and apply it to the Hamiltonian, chiral Hamiltonian I wrote before, we can get the density of states 1 over E log cube E, which I quoted before. But if we are very mathematically oriented people and if we trace how the mapping from that chiral problem to the sigma model works, we will discover that actually in one dimension it breaks down. And still somehow the answer turns out to be correct. So there is some kind of enigma of the sigma models, which perhaps is not understood correctly or fully understood, which makes them to be so powerful. Well, so I told you that there are the sigma models, and so here I've been facing a question whether I should spend a lot of time explaining what the sigma models are and where they come from. And so I decided in the end that my talk will not be complete if I tell you at least on some very qualitative basis why the sigma models show up. So I'll try to do this very briefly, and I apologize if it will come out to be fast, because the derivation of sigma models at the stage as we know it right now is extremely technical. There's a number of approximations we have to make on the way, which a priori is not clear if they break down. Some regimes they do break down. So somehow I believe that sigma models are more powerful than the approximations we do to derive them, but it's not clear why they're more powerful. So unfortunately, since I cannot say any more than this, I'm stuck to just repeat the standard derivation of sigma models. So let me very quickly go over how the sigma models are derived. But first of all, the sigma models are not just sigma models, they're supersymmetric sigma models. What I mean by this is the field Q is not a matrix, it's a supermatrix. So very briefly, I'll tell you what supermatrix is. So supermatrix is just analog of an ordinary matrix, but ordinary matrix is a transformation of vectors whose components are just numbers. And supermatrix is a transformation of a vector, one of whose component is a bosonic number, commuting number, and the other component is fermionic number, anti-commuting number. And so because of this, if we look at the structure of supermatrix, we'll discover that what stands on the diagonal is commuting, and what is on the off-diagonal is anti-commuting. It's because if we do the multiplication, the upper element of the vector goes into these elements. It better be commuting. So phi, and then A has to be commuting, and B has to be anti-commuting. And then C has to be anti-commuting, and D has to be commuting. And so this is the generalization of usual 2x2 matrix. So this matrix is sometimes called GL2, general linear group, size 2 matrices. And this matrix is often referred to as GL1/1. It means that the 2x2A matrix, which acts on a vector whose one component is commuting and one component is anti-commuting. So this is the notation which I'll use in the remainder of this talk. And I'll briefly tell you also why we need the supersymmetry. Well, the supersymmetry comes because of the disorder. So when we deal with random Hamiltonians, we need to compute Green's function. Now, Green's functions, they can be computed, can be mapped into this field theory. And so people like this representation of Green's functions because instead of working with the Schrodinger equation, we can work with field theories, and somehow field theories are easier to understand. But there is a little problem that when we write this in terms of field theories, it's not clear how to average over random potential, because random potential enters in many places. It enters here, it also enters in this 1 over z. And actually, even if it were possible to average over random potential, the theory we would get wouldn't be local. It would be very strange. It wouldn't be a field theory, in other words. The only way to keep it being field theory is to introduce so-called fermionic variable trick. Well, there's also another trick called replica trick, but in many ways it's complementary to supersymmetry, at least in this approach. And so in the end of the day, it's possible to express this Green's function as certain supersymmetric local field theory. By supersymmetry, I mean there are bosonic variables and fermionic variables, and there's a symmetry of rotation in the space of bosonic and fermionic variables. So every time we work with disordered problems, somehow we expect that if we manage to derive a field theory, it has to have these bosonic and fermionic fields in it. And then roughly, so how do people derive the sigma models? It's a sketch of a calculation, not really a calculation. What people say is that, well, they say the Green's function of our original problem can be mapped onto certain field theories, which are supersymmetric, and so this is schematically how the field theory look. And we average over disorder, so we get interacting supersymmetric field theories. And then we introduce an auxiliary field, which is a matrix field with bosonic and fermionic elements. And so up to this point, up to introduction of this field, everything is exact. But then we try to do saddle point approximation. And, well, equations for saddle point approximation look something like this. And we try to solve them. And solutions of this saddle point approximation identify a certain group, or sometimes costed space of matrices Q, whatever that means. And so in the end, when we do expansion, small oscillations around the saddle point, we derive this action, which looks like a sigma model, both with a kinetic term and with a source term, which term, it depends on what it is exactly we want to compute. It's written only schematically here, but it depends on the external parameters, such as energy, and usually it's linear in field Q. So where does the discrete symmetry of the Hamiltonian enters in this derivation? Well, it enters actually on this stage. So when we try, well, at this stage, Q is just some auxiliary variable over which we're integrating. But at this stage, we have to identify the solution to this equation. It's a complicated matrix equation because Q is a matrix. And depending whether this is just a standard Hamiltonian of just a particle which moves somewhere, or maybe it's a chiral Hamiltonian of the kind I wrote before, like in the random Bond-Isaac model, we will discover that Q will be a different kind of matrix. And so this is where the discrete symmetry of the Hamiltonian gets reflected in the symmetries of the sigma model. So as you see, it's very strange because this derivation is perturbative, and well, clearly there is some assumption that the perturbative approximation works, and actually one can show that, for example, when we do this calculation on electrons and metal, this perturbative calculation works only when the conductance is very large. In particular, in one dimension, we know that conductance is zero, and so that shouldn't work at all. Conductance, the relevant parameter is the conductance. And yet, somehow, somehow in the universal sense of the word, sigma model captures everything which is universal, which is independent of the disorder distribution. And why this is so is perhaps not entirely clear. So this is a table which Zumbauer wrote. So I know that it looks kind of scary, but I'm going to go through this table and explain roughly what it means and what kind of Hamiltonians we expect to have. So what Zumbauer noticed is that there's only 10 sigma models we can write down because there's only 10 kind of groups. Yeah, it changes the saddle point. There's more than one saddle point, and so it changes the entire manifold of saddle points, so to say. But unfortunately, the only way to see it is to actually go through the calculations. And, well, they exist in the literature, but I don't know of any way to understand it other than by doing the calculation. And that's why I'm thinking that this is not a satisfactory situation. So what Zumbauer noticed is that there are only 10 possible ways to write down this matrix Q. So it depends on what kind of saddle point manifold, or what kind of matrix or group or coset space we get. So these are notations of supergroups. I told you that Q is a supermatrix, so it's a member of a supergroup or a supercoset space. And so we can write, in principle, 10 possible Q matrices. And now each of those Q matrices through this strange saddle point calculation is related to a Hamiltonian. And then it turns out that, well, if the Hamiltonian is a matrix, then exponential of the Hamiltonian belongs to a group. And we can list down these groups. And it turns out there's a relationship between these, which go somehow through the saddle point calculation. And then the fact that Hamiltonian belong to one of these groups can be expressed in terms of this discrete symmetries which we impose on the Hamiltonian. So a little bit later I'll go through this table in more detail, but I don't want to go through it while it's here because it's just too much information overall. But let me just tell you. So these lines are universality classes. They're labeled by these letters, which are taken from the theory of so-called Riemannian symmetric spaces, because these objects are Riemannian symmetric spaces. And these are Cartan notations, which Zinnbauer borrows from his work. And so he suggested, which and is now generally accepted, to call the 10 various cases of Hamiltonians by these letters. They look not very simple, but that's how in the literature people write. So the people say, let's look at the Hamiltonian which belongs to class D. It means let's look at the Hamiltonian which has this property that if you compute its transpose and then there's some sigma 1 matrix, Pauli matrix floating around, you conjugate, Hamiltonian changes sign. That means that we're in class D. Yes, and now, so as I said, as far as this column is concerned, let's say that if the Hamiltonian is arbitrary, then exponential of I Hamiltonian is just a unitary matrix. But if Hamiltonian is symmetric, then one can check that exponential of I Hamiltonian is this coset space. And so this is a reflection of what this object is. And so one of the insights of Zinnbauer was that somehow the reason why this Q belongs to these coset spaces or groups comes because the Hamiltonian, when you impose discrete symmetries on it, it no longer generates unitary groups, but it generates various subsets of unitary groups according to what exponential of IH is. So let me now go through these classes and tell you a bit where they show up and where we could expect to see them in which situations. So many of these classes are now very relevant. Some of them are now proposed for superconductors, some are proposed for other experimentally observed situations with disorder. So let me just list them. So the first three universality classes are the ones which people knew about for a long time. Perhaps they go back to Wigner and Dyson, who considered random matrix ensembles, which is also in a way disordered problems, just Hamiltonians which are completely random, just a matrix whose every matrix element is random. So the first class is, by now, by this terminology Zinnbauer introduced, we call it class A. It's a Hamiltonians which have no restrictions. They could be anything. An exponential of I Hamiltonian, if Hamiltonian is a matrix, and this exponential is a unitary matrix. Then the second class is the class of symmetric Hamiltonians. And we understand this means that we have time reversal invariance. It means that the Hamiltonian is real. Every time it's symmetric, it's also real. So let's say we study metals and we study the electrons of metals, and there's no magnetic field, we're in this class. But if there is magnetic field, we go into this class because we break this symmetry. So once we have this symmetry, then this U matrix is no longer UN, rather it's this ratio. So how do we see it? That was on the table I showed to you before, but I just want to explain how these things come about. Well, arbitrary Hamiltonian can be written down as something which is symmetric times I, something anti-symmetric. Now, our Hamiltonian, unless S survives, this omega should disappear because it's symmetric. We should cross out omega. But anti-symmetric matrices, we know they generate ON. Exponentials of anti-symmetric matrices are orthogonal matrices. So this object has to be this ratio. And so every time we have something which is time reversal invariant, we say, well, it's class A1. And then we can look up in the table and see how it acts, how it works. Then there is a class A3. I'm sorry, class A2. Class A2 is when we have time reversal invariance, and we also have spins, but we have no spin rotation invariance. Because we have spins, the time reversal process is no longer transposed, but it's transposed plus flipping of the spin. And that changes what matrix U, exponential of IH, what it belongs to. It now belongs to this ratio. And so that's another class. Now that's the first three classes. The next three classes are so-called chiral classes. They're related to what I talked about in the first half of my talk. So one of them, we call it A3. That's the class of matrices which look like this, or Hamiltonians which look like this. So in other words, there is always an operator, sigma 3, such that we conjugate Hamiltonian with it and change in sign. And so one particular example, which has been studied a lot in the last maybe 5 years by a number of people, is the so-called random hopping problem. A particle which hops on a line, and it hops in one direction with an amplitude t, and in the opposite direction with the amplitude t star. That's how we can write down this Hamiltonian. One can check that it indeed has this form, even though perhaps it's not so clear. We take this matrix sigma 3, which is 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1. As we go along the line, indeed, this is true. And so, yes. And so the density of states for this problem, by the way, will be 1 over e log cube e, according to what I discussed before. Then another situation is class BD1. That's the same as chiral matrices, but also real chiral matrices. And well, technically speaking, what I told you about in the first half of my talk was class BD1. Well, a chiral matrix, which also was real, I had no complex numbers there. And it so happens that both of them in one dimension behaves as 1 over e log qb. I mean, the density of states behaves as 1 over e log qb. And then finally, there is another class, which is more obscure because there are no realizations of it, which people studied so far. It's the same as I3, but there's no there's also spin. Time reversal invariance without spin rotation invariance. And so now we already have six classes. We have three standard classes and three classes with chiral symmetry. The remaining four classes, as Alton and Zimbauer suggested in their work, which finally made people to start looking or thinking about these kind of new classes. So these classes are realized by Hamiltonians, which looks like BCS Hamiltonians. We imagine to have some electron creation and annihilation operator, and we also have a gap function. This looks like BCS. And, well, in that case, this gap function and H can be combined together into this matrix. So the matrix has this discrete symmetry as a consequence of A being fermion creation and annihilation operators. And if we look at the table which I showed to you, we recognize that this is class D. Another way to see that this is class D is to notice that by suitable transformation, the Hamiltonian can be made to be real anti-symmetric matrix, in which case this exponential is just an orthogonal matrix. And it's one of the signatures of class D matrices that this evolution operator, exponential of IH, is real. That means that we're in class D. And so this problem by itself, I'm not sure how it is relevant for superconductors because there's not enough symmetries here. But it turns out that in more generic random bond Isaac model problem, where the bonds are allowed to be not only positive but also negative, and they're correlated in both space, when they're random in both space and time direction, unlike the problem I considered before, then it indeed belongs to class D. And there was a large number of activity to understand class Ds from the point of view of sigma models and from the point of view of other methods, so-called Checker-Coddington network models. And so this is, I think, an incomplete list of papers which came out recently. So somehow the belief is that since this random bond Isaac model is a model of spin glass, at least at zero temperature, perhaps we can understand spin glasses using this technique. Now, a second superconducting class, so to say, is we still have BCS theory, but we also have spin rotation invariance. So after we impose spin rotation invariance, we discover that we can go to so-called Nambu basis, in which the matrix becomes, it looks like this. The B is symmetric, and in other words, H satisfies this property. And so this situation is realized in a superconductor in a magnetic field. We need magnetic field to break time reversal invariance, which we did not impose here. And so it was studied by a number of people. It was studied by people who were interested in superconductors, type 2 superconductors with vortices, magnetic vortices going through them. Clearly, it's a superconductor in a magnetic field. And then so that's the paper where the properties of that was studied. And then another situation which has been very thoroughly studied recently is so-called spin quantum Hall transition of D-wave superconductors. So notice how diverse situations are. One is conventional superconductor, the other is D-wave superconductor. The only thing which matters is that the Hamiltonian has this discrete symmetry, this one. Or in other words, this is class C. And then everything else can be read off sigma models and some calculations. We shouldn't be even worrying about what's going on inside the superconductor. it's only important that the Hamiltonian has this form. And then finally, there are two more classes, because altogether there are 10. One of them is when we have time reversal invariants and spin rotation invariants, in which case what the situation describes excitation of D wave superconductor but without magnetic fields. And so that was studied by actually a large number of people, beginning from the work of Zwelek in 93, and then there was the work of Sentil and Fisher in 98, I think, in 99. And then there was a work of Altman and Bauer and Simons, which put all these works together. And so essentially, if we're interested in properties of excitations of D-wave superconductor, all we need to do is to study how class C1 random Hamiltonians behave. And we can find out how D-wave superconductors behave. So let me notice that all these unusual symmetry classes, they have one thing in common, that they have a special energy E0 and a symmetry operation, such as chiral symmetry or some other symmetry operation, which relates states with positive and negative energies, or in other words, energies higher than E0 and less than E0. And so somehow this is a key thing. If we study something, we ended up with a Hamiltonian, and we discover that there is a symmetry operation, for sure we're in one of those 7 unusual universality classes, not in the 3 usual universality classes. Well, and so now that all these Hamiltonians are classified, basically the work becomes really simple. All we need to do is to study this field series. And so in the last 3 to 4 years, there was a flood of papers where people were looking at all possible classes of universality, and they would look at how this thing behaves when Q is one of those groups of coset spaces, and they would study it in 3D, and there's a non-trivial fixed point, which we know is analog of so-called Anderson localization transition. In 2D, there could be 2 different types of behaviors. So there could be a transition, or there could be no transition. Then there's also a possibility of so-called topological term, which can lead to quantum Hall transitions. But quantum Hall transition is only one of these classes. It's a transition in 2 dimensions where we have only a break of time reversal invariants, but we don't have all the superconducting things. If we're in one of the superconducting classes, then we get analogs of quantum Hall transitions, which have been studied. Spin quantum Hall transition I mentioned as one of them, but there are others, and some of them are not completely understood. Some of them could be related to some transitions in sort of spin glasses, I would say, as I mentioned, it is related to spin glasses. Okay, so I think this gives you an idea about in what sense we understand what's going on with time-independent disorder. So I just want, I cannot not to give you one example of a problem which I really like, that sometimes when we work on these problems with disorder, it's not even clear to begin with to which class, which universality class we belong. Well, if we have a Hamiltonian which is nicely written, we can see, oh, it has this symmetry, then obviously we can just look at the table and see how it behaves. But sometimes it's less clear, and so a certain work which I did recently with Choker, Altman, and Bauer were interested in a general property of a situation where we have an energy functional and we have a minimum of this functional. Let's say this energy functional is maybe energy of interacting spins. Maybe we're at 0 temperature, so all spins try to find the minimum of the energy, look in some direction. And then we're interested in the properties of fluctuations around this minimum. So this looks like a random Hamiltonian. What kind of universality class is this? Well, at first it doesn't even look like a universality class. You'd say, well, this looks like it's symmetric, so probably it's just symmetric real functions, and maybe that's it. But that's not true, because the eigenvalues of H are positive. But I told you before that being positive doesn't mean anything. I gave an example of a positive Hamiltonian, which still didn't belong to one of those new classes. But there is still a chance that maybe it does. Maybe it can be expressed in this form. And so it turns out it is true. For all the problems of this type, it is true. And so the particular example we have in mind, which I'll show real fast without explaining much, we meant some kind of disorder spin chains. So we meant spin glasses, actually. But this is a simple example of the spin chains. So the energies are just spin-spin interaction and magnetic field. The magnetic field is random, spin-spin interaction is random. So in the continuum limit, you get something like this. And the minimum energy, it's something like this. And so we're interested in the spectrum of oscillation around the minimum energy. Now it can be shown, as it turns out, that this operator is indeed can be, it indeed can be written down as this product of the chiral type problems I wrote to you before, where this V of x can be related to the value of the energy computed with certain boundary conditions. And so in the end, it's possible actually to find the spectrum of this problem, which is a certain unsolved problem in physics, also related to the properties of charge density waves. So apparently the spectrum, it's in the regime where V has expectation value, so the spectrum is a power law. So I just wanted to mention this because often we start with a problem which is not clearly one of these universality classes, but well, so far as I can see, every time you have a problem, if you work hard enough, as in here, and in the end, all of a sudden, you discover, this is one of those universality classes. So then, as soon as you get something like this, basically you can stop working. The problem is solved for you. You just look it up in the table. So to conclude, let me mention what is known and what is not known, in my personal opinion. So we now understand that these problems of time-independent disorder can be somehow all captured by the properties of field theories called sigma models. There are only 10 sigma models one can write down. And so there are only 10 types of behaviors of random problems. Now, well, these 10 types of behaviors are usually referred to as 10 symmetry classes. But within each symmetry class, the actual behavior depends on, well, a number of other things. For example, maybe we're in one dimension, then we have one type of behavior. If we're in two dimensions, we might have another type of behavior, since the exact properties of sigma model might change depending on the number of dimensions. And so these are usually referred to as universality classes. So within 10 symmetry classes, within each class, there are perhaps several universality classes. And so the work, which hasn't been done yet, is to understand all possible universal behaviors which contain within one symmetry class. What is understood is that there are 10 symmetry classes, and as long as the sigma models work, there could not be any more symmetry classes. So the work which still left for us is, well, look for more realizations of these universality classes, and well, perhaps look for problems which somehow maybe don't map into sigma models for some reason, and maybe they don't fall into the 10 universality classes. But so far, no one has seen these models. And well, on the other hand, maybe there are no such models, but then maybe we should understand why there are no such situations, why everything is captured by the sigma models. And that would also be very nice to understand, and that's an unsolved problem. Right, thank you. Well, it depends on what you're looking at. So for two-dimensional random bond Isaac model, we know its universality class, its symmetry class D, but because it's in two dimensions, it can only be a spin glass at zero temperature. So it's a particular universality class within symmetry class D. It's a two-dimensional spin glass. And actually, three-dimensional spin glass, that's, I don't know, because I haven't worked on that yet.
But you're saying that it falls within one of these classes?
It probably falls in one of these classes, but that's something which I haven't looked into yet, so I cannot tell you. You see, it's a universality class, or a regime of behavior, which hasn't been explored yet. So in two dimensions, we know, because of the work of the people I quoted, that it's class D. If you're in three dimensions, the methods they used were specifically valid for two dimensions, so their method fail. So you need to come up with something new. The method which was shown as class D is a specifically two-dimensional method.
Professor Weidenmüller?
You will use the nonlinear sigma model for two purposes in the talk, namely to motivate the occurrence of symmetries, symmetry classes, and then also as a means to calculate properties. Concerning the first step, I have the impression that we can also use directly multi-radical arguments to obtain the classification scheme. Is that correct? And can you say something about that? But that would need not go, I think, through the non-linear sigma method.
Well, I'm not sure I exactly understand what you mean. We can motivate sigma models by groups of radical arguments, because these are the only sigma models we can write down. We can perhaps motivate random matrix theories by groups of radical arguments. If the Hamiltonian is a random matrix, then maybe we can argue that this is one of these Riemannian symmetric classes, because it should be as random as possible, entropic argument and other arguments. And anyway, in the end, we'll also motivate these classes. But if we look at something like, I don't know, this one-dimensional spin chain, which I showed in my last transparency, I don't know how to use group theoretical argument to motivate that this is a symmetry class BD1.
Question over here. Yeah, I have a confusion in my mind. In the old classical paper by Dyson, the so-called, the famous threefold way, which means symplectic, the unitary orthogonal symplectic cases, one sees the argument that if there are other symmetries in the problem and one restricts oneself to the subspace of a good quantum number associated with that symmetry, then one should fall into one of the three classes studied before. That's what Dyson says. Is that consistent with the argumentation given for having seven more classes?
Well, so I'm not sure how exactly Dyson's argument went in this instance. But I know where exactly, I know what is the usual thing people say when they say why Dyson's argument failed. And that is the Dyson never assumed that in the spectrum there could be a special point. So Dyson assumed that all points in the spectrum are more or less the same. So for his random matrices, he said, as long as we're within this Wigner semicircle, it doesn't really matter what the energy is equal to. For this new universality classes, there is always a special energy, which is, well, it's special. So you can, and things could depend when you come close to this energy in a certain way, which is different from how Wigner Dyson predicted. So in particular, the very large energies, which are much bigger than that, or very far from that energy, for example, there are many levels in between that energy and special energy, will usually cross over back to Dyson's universality classes. So for example, for superconductors, the special energy is the Fermi level. So if we study excitations very close to the Fermi level, we'll discover that they fall into these new classes. If you go to very large energies, actually we'll cross over back to the standard classes. But it's just that for physics of superconductors, important energies are lower ones. That's why we should look in these new classes.
Professor Bogigas?
Could you comment about comparing the approach you are describing with
Well, for these new universality classes, you could do a calculation which is similar to the one Dyson did. And actually, I have a transparency which I can show what you will get if you repeat Dyson's calculation, or maybe Wigner's calculation for these new universality classes. Let me show it. Okay. So here is the, well, usually people, when they study random matrices, they look at joint eigenvalue distribution, joint eigenvalue distribution for eigenvalues of these matrices. And so usually the formula looks like this. So this term lambda to the alpha is absent, and this is the term we get by Wigner-Dyson and that exponential prefactor. So the new universalities classes are different in the sense that there's an additional term here which controls what happens when eigenvalues are small. And so here I measure the value of alpha, obviously, from that special energy level E naught, which always is present in these new universality classes. And so in principle, you can even argue that for each of the 10 universality classes, there is a pair of alpha and beta. And so for each universality class, you can compute what alpha and beta are equal to, and that affects behavior of the density of states and other things. And so one of the ways to figure out on what universality class you are, if you don't know, is to look at this probability distribution of eigenvalues and compute this alpha and beta. And I'm looking at the table, and the table tells you, if alpha is 1 and beta is 2, it means that you are in the chiral class A1, or I mean A3.
Yeah, but this is not my question. My question is, technically, you want to compute correlation problems. Which method will be more for?
Which method? Orthogonal polynomials. It depends on the case.
Because for instance, the Laguerre polynomial, all that is one
kind of case. So you see, it actually depends very much on the values of alpha and beta. When alpha is 0, the standard method goes through. Let's say alpha is 1. If alpha is 1, then what we can do is we can sort of, the measure is now alpha d alpha, so we can call alpha square a new variable, and that's how you get Laguerre polynomials. And then for superconducting classes, these things, they take more complicated values. I mean, you will no longer be able to use this trick. And so people come up with different tricks every time, actually. And sometimes people just forget about it and do calculations with the sigma model, which is another way to do these calculations, or with other tricks. So I don't know if I know how to compute, how to solve every case using orthogonal polynomials. Maybe it's possible, but I'd like to hear more about that, because I think there are some classes for which I don't know how to do it in orthogonal polynomials.
Zakata?
On your last example, would you say that if you have a complicated ground state like that of a protein, and you get excitations, it would belong to this chiral class, or what else do I need to know about the system?
Well, the kind of derivation we have so far, it's only worked well if you have something which is one-dimensional. Random one-dimensional, and you want to compute excitation around the minimum. Then I think I know that it's always chiral. If you're in more than one dimension, there are some problems. It is still chiral, but it's not clear how to compute the behavior. It's a very complicated chiral situation with a complicated universality class, if you wish. So I'm less sure about that, but in one dimension, I'm sure.
The other questions? As I said at the colloquium last week, I'm always bothered by the fact that only older people ask questions. The young people never ask questions. They seem to understand everything. So young people are encouraged to ask questions. Young people are encouraged to ask questions, students, postdocs. No question? Okay. Well, let's thank the speaker. Thank you.